The lessons for Ramban, and it opened up a new idea. Because the interesting thing, we went over it a number of times, and we studied these stories. It's an amazing thing. I mean, of course, the Torah is the infinite wisdom of God, and the person thinks he went through an area that he knows any other way. And it's just basically repetition. It's not the case. There's no area that you could say that you've exhausted it.
Every area, even if you know the general, and you've done it very well, but
every pasuk and every word in every pasuk is so.
It's so filled with ideas and nuances that it's impossible to just say you've exhausted an area.
It's only when you say that, I mean, relatively speaking. Let's just take up an illustration of that.
What sense is the mouth?
First day, right, that's two.
Pasuk Chasim of 23.
This is when Moshe is in Midian,
and right after the incident where he encounters
Yisro, and he saves the daughter of Yisro from the shepherds, and now he's the daughter of Yisro, the Torah, and his child Jacob. Then it introduces us, Chav Gimel introduces us to the next phase, which is the revelation of God to Moshe at the burning bush. Take a look at Chav Gimel. There's an introduction over there. And it was during those many days, one of those many days that we're referring to, 3 days that Moshe was in Midian. According to the Ramban, we went over this, if you remember, Ramban mentioned that there was a long period, many, many years went by, while Moshe was in Midian before. And his meeting with Yisro and the marriage takes place at the end of that day when he's, how old at this point? He was 80 years old when he returned to Mitzrayim, and as we know that, because he died at 120, and 40 years in the world, 40 years from the time of, from the time he returned to Mitzrayim until he died was 40 years. So he's 80 years old. So Vayom Nahim, and the Ramban, based himself on Chazal, learned that he ran away when he was young. He ran away when he was approximately either 12 years old, or maybe a little bit. That's different opinions, but not older than 20. So he spent many years, almost at least 60 years, perhaps more, in Midian. Then it says like this. It was during those many days, and the king of Egypt died. And the Jews groaned from the work, by Yizaku, and they screamed out. And their cry went up to God from the avodah, from the work. And God heard their pain. And God remembered his covenant with Avram as Yitzchak Yisrael that he had made with Avram Yitzchak. Vayar Elohim et Bnei Yisrael, and God saw the Bnei Yisrael, the children of Israel. Vayega Elohim, and God knew. It's a very hard puzzle. What do you mean Vayega Elohim? And God knew. What do you mean God knew? What he doesn't tell us what he knew. But Rashi says, nothing Elohim lay, he turned his attention to them. Below hell and Anab, and he didn't turn away from them. Of course you can't take this literally. Because taken literally, the idea that God doesn't pay attention to one thing, then withdraws attention. So it's not meant to be taken literally, but it meant, apparently, that God was going to effectuate, was going to bring about a change in the situation, obviously. That's what it means. You can't take it literally. But I'm concerned, what interests me is Pasuk Chav Gimel. This is the transition point, obviously, and then it says that's leading us up into chapter 3, which talks about the fact that Moshe was a shepherd, and he went into the wilderness, and he started a burning bush. I'm interested in Pasuk Chav Gimel. What strikes us in Pasuk Chav Gimel? What strikes your attention? It seems obvious, and we take it for granted. What is the relevance? What's the significance of the fact that the king died? Now, the king died, I understand. Apparently, with the death of the king, the situation got worse. All right, by Yom Kippur time, In other words, it became entrenched, and the next thing came along, and apparently got worse. Fine. And the Jews groaned from the work. Okay, so if you're telling me that the situation, it would appear that the situation was deteriorated very badly for the Jews. And therefore, God cured the situation, and the enslavement was necessary to bring, as we discussed, why the enslavement was necessary, to bring the Jews into a certain state of mind in which they would be more amenable to accepting the system of mitzvot, as we explained. On the other hand, the situation, couldn't go so far that they'd be totally broken, they wouldn't be able to emerge. So there were two elements. In other words, it was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it was necessary. On the other hand, too much of it could be totally destructive. So, plainly, if God saw that the situation was reaching the point where they would have to be redeemed, that it achieved its purpose. It had achieved its purpose. That's basically the way I would explain it. This is the introduction. God saw that the time had arrived, that all the pain, all the suffering that they had to endure to bring about their willingness to accept Torah. He said that they were the only nation that was going to accept the Torah way of life. That had already been accomplished, but past this point is going to, you can drive a person to a certain amount of deprivation is beneficial spiritually, but too much can break the person. So it's no good. Fine. But what does it have to do with Vayuzaku? And they cried out. And Vatal Shavasam El Holokim in Haroga. And their screams went up to God, their screams from the work. What is that doing? What is it telling us? Who cares? Well, not who cares. Yeah, who cares? I mean, what's the significance? It means it's telling us something. That they cried out to God. One is that they cried out to God, and two is that their cries went up to God. And that's a strange kind of an expression. I mean, they prayed to God. What do you mean that prayers went up to God? And what kind of an idea is that? I mean, what does that mean? Prayers have to break through certain elements that are blocking them and they go up to God? I'd like to understand the significance of that. That doesn't seem to play a role over here. And why is that important? Maybe when I have to go through the story of the snap, which I'm not going to go through pocket by pocket. Alright? As you all know, Moshe sees that it's not burning, he turns to get closer, and God. The voice, not God, of course, God himself can speak them, but a voice created by God. But the message is prophecy. Speak to God, to Moshe. From the book. Alright? Then, he is so involved, God identifies himself, I'm the God of your fathers. And Moshe covered his face because he was afraid to look at God. Now, from Zion on, God addresses him and tells him what the purpose of the revelation is all about. And I've seen the affliction. God said, I've seen the affliction of my nation that's in Egypt. And he made, but asked God to come from Mati, and it made no trouble. And their screams have I heard from those who oppress them, their taskmasters. For I know their pain. So there's one reference to God hearing their screams. See, I'm going to concentrate. What I'm trying to concentrate on basically, what is the significance of the fact that God hears their screams? With regard to the whole idea of the redemption. And for Ares, and I've come down to save them from Ephraim and to bring them up from that land, to the land of milk and honey, to the place of the county, etc. Alright, fine. Then the test is repeated. And now, behold, the screams of the children of Israel have come to me. And also I've seen the oppression that Mitzrayim is oppressing them. Now that seems to be repetitive, is it not? Because it says, and now their screams have come to me. It just mentioned before, in Pasuk Zion, the Estakosam Shamati. They know so. Doesn't it seem to be almost identical with the repetition? You know, the Torah doesn't repeat. Anyone who compares Zion, at least, of course, when I say it's redundant, I'm talking on the superficial level. Obviously, it's not, but I mean, we have to notice the problem. At first glance, it seems to be repetitious. God is saying to Moshe in his first address to Moshe, I've heard their cries from before their taskmasters. Then in Prophet God, he says, and now, behold, the cries or the screams, Tzaraka, the screams, of the Bnei Israel have come to me. Okay? So it seems repetitious. And then, in test, and you'd rather be command. And now go, I will send you to Pharaoh, and remove my people, and take out my people from the triumph. And then you have the arguments of Moshe. Of course, Moshe resists. That's something else. We're not taking it up right now. My question is that it seems to me Moshe has this whole discussion with God, like, what is he merited to do to be redeemed? As he said, according to Rashi, who am I? We are no Chiyar Chapar, but I should get a pile. And the Peyotius made a film, and I'll take them out of Egypt. So Moshe meant, by what merit? What merit do the Jews have to warrant their being taken out of Egypt? Even if you say that I am worthy, why are they unique? That they warrant your intervention. To which God answered that this is a sign that I'll be with you, and this is a sign that I sent you. When I remove the nation from Egypt, they will worship me on this mountain. So Rashi says that is the answer to the second question. You want to know what is their merit? The answer is that their merit is in the future. Your assumption is that they have to be worthy of redemption right now. The answer is no. They're not worthy right now, but they're designated. They have been designated by me for a certain mission, which is to receive the Torah. They will worship me. So that is the reason why I'm intervening. They will worship God in this mountain, which means Matan Torah. They'll receive the Torah, and they'll become a special nation, and that's their purpose. So for that purpose, they deserve to be redeemed. Now, that makes a lot of sense to me. Which means to say, and this is the idea that we mentioned many times, that what is the idea of the Bechirat Am Yisrael, that we are a chosen people? It's definitely a basic principle of the Torah. But most people relate to that idea in the wrong way. God warns us in Devarim that lo me'rubchem, we shouldn't take any credit for this. Siyatim ha'ma'at mikala'aman. It's lo b'tikatra. Not because of your righteousness is God going to drive out the nations and give you out as well. It seems to say that there's nothing, you are not chosen because of anything unique about yourself, but nishama or sabris. It's only because of the covenant that God made with the fathers. Which means that the way we have to look at ourselves is that we are chosen by God and designated. Right? And the fact that we have the Torah elevates us to a higher level, but it's not because we're really better. It's not because we are inherently better. It's not a racial. To be Jewish is not a racial kind of thing. It's not just racial superiority. To live the life of a Jew is a superior way of life. And the reason why we were chosen is because we're the descendants of the Avos. The Avos were worthy. The Avos were unique people. They were different. They were worthy of being... They were worthy of being chosen. God chose the others. But when God formed a nation, and he wanted to have a nation that represented this way of life and maintained this way of life, the people who are most qualified to fulfill that mission would be the descendants of the fathers of the others. So we are fortunate that we happen to be, but that's an accident of birth. That doesn't give us any... You can't take credit for the fact that you come from great parents. So you realize that. Any success that he has, certainly any wealth that he has or success that he has simply because of inheritance, he definitely would be people are conceited about it, but it's absurd to be conceited about something which you really didn't. The question of being conceited at all is a question, even if you did accomplish it. But certainly now, if that's the case, my question is, so why are we here in preparing us for the idea that God is going to send Moshe Rabbeinu? What is this idea that they cried out to me, and they screamed to me, and they prayed to me, and their prayers. It seems to be that it has something to do with answering their prayers. And yet, on the other hand, we said it's not. God did not intervene and take them out to answer their prayers. It was a predetermined thing. It was all predetermined when he told Abraham. Way back when God had told Abraham, you should know, they'll be strangers in a land which is not theirs, and they'll be afflicted for 400 years. Happy from the birth of Yitzchak, of course, but they weren't in the throne. 400 years. And afterwards, Afterwards, I will remove them, right? And they'll, when they are, you should know, and the Gama Sutra, I'll also, I'll judge the nation that's afflicted them, that's justice, they'll be punished for it. And when they'll leave with great wealth. And all that was the Kriya. So if you ask me, what we have to know, what we need to know, is that in those days that come, when the enslavement had reached its peak, it achieved its objective, and now God's going to redeem them. The entire description of the fact that they cried out and their prayers have reached me just doesn't fit into that picture. What difference does it make? Maybe it's whether they did pray, whether they didn't pray, but the Torah is not just recording events. It seems to be a central theme, an integral component. And it is repeated again by when God tells Moshe. It tells him a lot of things. It's a lengthy description. It seems repetitive about all the reasons why they're being redeemed. And it mentions the fact that they have screamed out to me. But and these screams are mentioned twice. As I said, that's a separate problem. It's a problem within a problem. That is a problem within a problem. Because in Zion, as I said, in Zion it says, I've heard their screams, for I know their pain. And then, in perfect sense, it says, and now their screams have come to me. Now, what's the difference between my hearing their screams and their screams coming to me? It seems to be the same thing. Okay, that's my first question. That's my first question. I just have one other question. I don't know. In trying to answer it, I'm going to try and answer something else. I was working on something else yesterday. And it just occurred to me as I was working on this. I just decided to do this morning when I went to this Milano here. And I saw this connection. I don't know if this will answer the question or not. I'm just going to try it. It's going to be like an experiment. If you turn to chapter Dalet, that's 4. This is when God told Moshe that all the people were going to be doing Project Club Day. But prior to that, he just introduced to set up the situation. God has told him to return to Egypt 3 years after the 7 days at the Hashina, because Moshe and God were in a debate for 7 days, according to Chazal. So Moshe was, so God simply told him he has no choice. He has to accept the role. And then God tells him that all your enemies have died, so it's time to go back. Moses took his leave of Yisrael. He took his wife and children and put them on the Hamor, and they started to return to Mitzrayim, and he took the staff of God in his hand, the staff of which he performed the miracle. And then God told them when he goes to Chavalah, when you return to Egypt, see all the wonders, all the signs that are placed in your hands, and you shall perform them before Paro. And I will harden his heart, and he will not send out the people. So God is, again, God had told him at the Sinai, but God is reminding him of this, to be very strong, and not to be afraid, according to Rashi, to perform all these miracles. Now, take a look at the next two chickens. And you should say to Pharaoh, thus said God, beneath the Holy Israel, my child, my firstborn is Israel. Very moving kind of a statement, emotionally. It's a very interesting point. That's an interesting, right? That's the, you see, the Jews are called the children of God. Beneath the Holy, very close. Lush to the Dula. Rashi explains that the Bechor is used in the sense of Gedula. Like majesty, great. But the plain meaning, I would say, is the first. It means to say that ultimately all the nations, in the most of the year, all the nations will recognize God. So they'll all be the children of God. But the first will be the Bnei Israel. And the first also, they'll always be in a higher level. They're really both ideas. We're the first, and also the Jews will always be in a higher level. And the other nations will come to the Jews to receive the wisdom of the Torah. And continue now, and I said to you, and I say to you, Shalach et b'ni v'yadveni, send out my child, send out my son, and let him, that he may worship me. V'atimoyim l'shalcho, and if you refuse to send him forth, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. So he's warning him over here about Makas Bechorah. My question was, what's the point of all this? What is the reason? What is the reason over here? He's telling Moshe at the very beginning to tell Paro. This is before, I mean, this is, this is before all the other Makos have been done, all the other plagues, at the very beginning, to inform him that if he refuses, then he's going to throw out his firstborn son. But in telling him that, it's an interesting thing. See, in telling him that, he didn't just tell him as a threat, but that threat was joined up with the idea. Shalach Hashemi v'yavdeinu. You see, in other words, it's one thing to say that he warned him about the ultimate consequences. The ultimate consequences would be that if he refused, then there's going to come a time and all your bechorahs will be killed. But it's not put that way. It's put in the context of send out my son. By the way, it's interesting. How many people understood the reason for Makas Bechorah? Somebody was to ask you, why did God smite the first one? Did anybody know why? I mean, was it simply because that was extremely... I'm sorry? No. Pharaoh didn't make a decree against the first one. Pharaoh's decree was against Jewish males. See, I asked a few people, how many people know the reason for Makas Bechorah? I guess you would say, what? Well, now you go. This is a fact. The key is. I thought it was a piece of information. The Sforno explains it. You would probably say because God wanted to do something which would totally terrorize them and would break them down completely. And this was the most terrifying thing. As the Torah describes it, that night of my... But was it simply picking something which was the most terrorizing thing, or was there some reason for that particular? There could have been other things which were equally terrifying. Or was there something specific? So according to the Sforno, it wasn't just by accident that God took that, nor was it only because of the amount of terror. Other things could have brought about the same amount of terror. Could have brought them to their knees, but there was something particular, specific. Okay? We're going to try and pick that up. The first thing I want to do is get back to my original question. What is the role of Atal Shavak and Al-Horakim? Yep. Well, very to the point. Very simple. It appears that one of the factors which brought about, which was a cause in God's redeeming them, was their prayer. That is to say that if they had not prayed, it would appear that they would not have been redeemed. That, however, is problematical because their redemption was guaranteed then. They were not redeemed because of any merit that they possessed, and therefore it was only because of the future, because they were descendants of the fathers, and they were destined for Sinai, that's why they're being redeemed, which would indicate that it's irrelevant whether they prayed or didn't pray. So they did pray, they didn't pray, right? It's irrelevant. Let's say they hadn't prayed. They still would have had to be redeemed because then the promise wouldn't be fulfilled, and you'll say, well, why did they pray to God? Well, that's what Sinai, they'll get the Torah, they'll get the Mitzvah, they'll learn about prayer, they'll pray. However, in presenting it to us, the pasuk is doing more than that. It's not just describing they have to pray and God listens. It has to be of significance. It's a factor to be considered. It brings about the redemption. The prayer brought about the redemption. It contributed to the redemption in a certain way. It was a contributing factor in the redemption. That's all I'm saying. I don't want to put it down because that's basically what I look at it superficially, you know. No, I mean my first reaction. You take it wrong. The first glance, not superficially, it's a good shot. I don't mean it that way. In other words, okay, that's not so perfect. Good word. I used the wrong word. But I did think of that it would appear that it wasn't enough that they just undergo the suffering, but the suffering has to have the effect of what they're supposed to do. I think there's truth in that. I think that's truth in that. I used the wrong word. That, you know, that God would not turn away his eyes from them, which could be, that's a good point, could be that that meant that they were on a higher level. And we know that from suffering, that's why, that's the whole idea that if when a person is suffering, he is closer to God. When he goes to visit a sick person, he's not supposed to sit up next by his head because the sheen, so to speak, is by the head of a sick person, which means that when a person is in a state of illness, it brings him closer to God. And that even though he's supposed to be foul for the cholera, the best feeler is what he's responsible for himself, because his heart is truly broken, and he really is much more in line with the truth and reality. He's close to God. So that's valid. That's valid. That the feeler, no doubt, is significant in that it brings them close to God. Now, Malki's going further and saying that was really an inherent requirement in the Gula process. And had they not been this parallel, then they wouldn't have been close to God, and they wouldn't have been worshiping. Because to say that is a big point, to say that. I don't know. There's validity in what you're saying. All right, I want to... I just want... Yeah, you have a chance. I think the Rambam and the Ramban, they had a whole new dimension to this. It's a new idea. It's an additional idea. Okay? I don't think it detracts from what you're saying. We were learning in Deos, and one of the mitzvahs in Deos, right, the mitzvah, something we should all pay attention to, is that we may not, it's a mitzvah lo tasei, which the Rambam characterizes, to lo la'anos umolom, that we are prohibited from afflicting the lowly people. We're not allowed to afflict lowly people. Okay, what does that mean? The Rambam says in Perek Vav of Deos, that a person is obligated to be very careful concerning the Yisomim and Almanos. Concerning the orphans and the widows. Why? It may say, Nafsham follow the mode. Because their souls, their spirits are very low. The Rucham Namucha, and their spirit is very downtrodden. They're very downtrodden. Interesting, he adds, Afal Pishahim Bali Mama, even though they'd be wealthy. Why does he mention that? Why would he mention that they're wealthy? Because people don't relate to it that way. People will not have, in reality, you will not have the same attitude towards an orphan. You hear somebody die, an orphan, and less than $3 billion. So you're not going to have that kind of, they won't have that same rahmanas. Inwardly, you look at it totally differently. Because we tend, again, as we explained, that a person gets followers' emotions with regard to a mitzvah. Most people, their chesed is based upon how they feel about certain things. And the Torah, as you see, holds that the true chesed can't be just based on an emotion. It's based upon chachma, knowledge. That's what it says in Ezekiel. The Torah chesed alakana. The Torah chesed. The chesed is not just acting out your emotions. Which is, and how to tell you, all the chesed that you see is basically emotional. Like there's different groups. This one's fighting for this disease, this one's fighting for this cause. Every group is fighting for cause, and that's the only thing they care about. You'll see it's because of personal emotion. Not to say that it's not chesed. So it's still confusing. Chesed is chesed. You can't look chesed in the mouth, in other words. You can't say, well, he's only doing it because of suddenly. But the highest level of chesed is one which is based on Torah. Which means to say that the state of a yatom is a different. You look at it from your point of view. You don't have money, so you look up. You know, you're envious of people with money, so you think, well, he has money. That's it. But the person who is the child who lost his father has that emotion of being a yatom, and the fact that he has money doesn't compensate for him. So therefore, you have to look at it in the objective framework. And the same with the widow. Even if it be the widow of the king. He's a very prominent person. And the orphans, Lutaram Anu Alayam, we're warned about them. And it says, Kol Almana V'yosam Lo Ta'ana. It says, every Almana and Yosam you may not afflict. And therefore he says, Hey, Sohag, and you know how we could deal with them? He says, you should only speak very gently to them. The way you speak to them has to be extremely gentle. And you can only deal with them in a way of honor. Treat them with tremendous honor and respect. And you may not cause them any pain, physical pain, or or with tough words. You may not deal with them with tough words. And you must be concerned, very concerned about their money, more than your own money. You have to be very worried about their money. But you see today, who is it? Alright. So he says, whoever afflicts them, causes them any anger, any pain, puts them down, or destroys their money, he violates a negative command. He says, certainly anyone who hits them or curses them. And then he says like this, this prohibition, even though it doesn't carry the malchus lashes, you don't get the penalty of lashes, for different reasons, nevertheless, the punishment has been stated explicitly in the Torah, where it says, my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword. I'll get to that in a second. It says, a covenant, this Karaslam, God has a special covenant with them, these downtrodden people, that any time that they cry out from oppression, they're answered. As it says, himself feels like a lie, that if they cry out to me, I will hear their scream. I will hear their scream. Let's take a look at which the part that is the most. What says it? In Terah Chafei 22, Pasuk 20, starts in 20. That's about the Ger. There's a connection between, there's two mitzvahs. There's one mitzvah that you may not afflict the Ger, the convert, and there's a separate mitzvah to oppress the orphan and widow. So let's go through it quickly. If you have Shemot Chafei Chaf, it says the ger, the convert, you may not afflict or oppress. For you were ger, and you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Then it says, kol almana, this is the prophet we're talking about. Every almana and yosom and orphan, most honored, you may not humiliate or afflict. Now, an interesting prophet. Imane sa'ane oso, if you will afflict them, if they do scream out to me, I will hear their scream. V'chara'api, my anger will be kindled. V'ra'api yechem v'chara, and I will smite you with the sword. V'hayim v'sheichem almanos, and your wives will be widows. U'v'neichem yisamim. That was very powerful. And your children will be orphans. Very powerful revenge. And of course, as you know, the question arises, this seems to be the punishment of it seems to be extremely powerful. Yeah, for somebody's benefit, this is really a very powerful punishment. Because what did he do? I know, but first of all, you'll be killed with the sword. You'll be killed for this. The Rambam meant when he said, just because there are no lashes, the court. The best is, would not give the person lashes. Now, the wood, for example, if he ate certain forbidden foods, he'd get lashes. Don't think that just because there's no lashes over here, that's just not a serious offense, because it's going to be worse. Because God has a special covenant. There's a special covenant. And you're going to get wiped out? But not only that, it's very interesting, because Rashi asks, why does that mention that your wife will be widowed and your children will be orphaned? If it tells me that you're going to be killed, so of course your wife. Doesn't have to repeat it. So it means, so Chazal say, it's even worse. It means that they'll be permanent almanos. They'll die in such a way that you're like a missing in action in a war. You'll die in a war, and they won't even be able to verify that you're dead. So the wife will be like an adulterer. She won't have it. She'll be an almanos. She'll have a husband, and she won't be able to be married because she won't be able to prove. There won't be any proof. That's an additional. That's a punishment on top of a punishment. Punishment to the wife. Yeah. I know. That's what we took up. That we took up in the I'm not taking that part up here. That we did it. And the children will be your children. What does that mean? That means for the same, they won't even have the benefits of their father's Yerusha. Because it's one thing, like we said before, the fact that they have money doesn't take them out of that space, but it certainly helps. A person is not destitute if they have some money that gives them a certain security. So it means to say that your children will not inherit your money because Bezin moves in and will lock up the estate, will not allow the children to get it because
perhaps he's alive. Job can't take it. If a soldier is missing in action and can't be verified, you see, always been a very important issue to the Jewish people. I mean, I've never heard you see that this whole business and, you know, with the negotiation with the release of prisoners with Lebanon, how much Israel is going to do just to have information. I don't even think the rest of the world can even understand. They're willing to give up like all their prisoners just to get, not even to return the body, just to find out. I don't think the rest of the world understands how important it is. To the, you know, to the wife and the children. So, so that's one question. Why is this call for such a severe punishment? Now, we can all identify, we all understand that it's a terrible thing to afflict the humble, to afflict the weak. It's the wrong thing, but basically, you shouldn't afflict anybody. You shouldn't oppress anybody, not just the Almana. If I was to ask you, if you were to ask me, I would say, is one permitted to afflict, oppress the Almana, the Asim? I would say, the same thing. You can't oppress any fellow Jew. What's the difference? It's worse. Certainly, I would say that, you know, the more vulnerable the individual, the worse the oppression. But you may not oppress any Jew, even a person that's not on money. If a person's not on money, you're allowed to oppress them. You're allowed to mistreat them. No! So I would say that this should be subsumed in the same heading of afflicting an ordinary Jew. Only it's worse in this case. But no, it's not. It's not worse. It's a category of sin in and of itself, and it's not subsumed in the same heading as that of oppressing an ordinary Jew. So we have to look into that. There's one other element over here that's interesting, and that is Pasuk Chav Bet. What is Pasuk Chav Bet? And this will tie us back into the problems that we started with. And that is that there's one condition. This is a terrible punishment that God will mete out, but there's one condition. If they cry out to me. If they cry out to me, Shamay Shamakala, which implies that if they don't cry out to me, then you're saved. Which again, that's a problem because, again, I'm on a shot. Either this is your, you know, the crime, you're guilty, you committed the crime, this is your punishment. What difference does it make if they should cry out to God or not? Doesn't need to be that should be the deciding factor. It's almost like in America, there's a whole deterioration of the punishment system, so it's like, the relatives demand that, there's pressure from the relatives. I mean, it's not justice. Justice should be. The person needs to get what he deserves, regardless, because a certain person was sentenced to a harsh punishment because the relatives were provided for tremendous pressure. They killed their loved ones. Another person who doesn't have relatives, and nobody cares, so this person is a lighter person. That's justice. And justice should be objective. A killer should get what they shouldn't be in need. It's a tragedy. Every time you read how the relatives make sure to be in court, but it implies that there's no true justice unless there's pressure. Everything is political pressure. There's no pressure, so you can get a lighter sentence. You put pressure on, so then you get more severe. Unfortunately, that's the way the system is. It shouldn't be that way. But how does it work over here? Here, the Torah, the God doesn't work that way. God is not subject to the pressure. If they cry out to God, and they pray that this, you know, it doesn't even say, the truth of the matter is, it doesn't even say that they, it doesn't mean that they cry out to God and demand that God do this to them. No, they cry out to God for help. But then I'll listen to them. That's very problematic. Now, I want to read Ramban. Some of you may be familiar with it. We've taken that before, but it's a very, very significant idea. Ramban takes an analysis from Pasuk Chav. The ger, you shall not afflict the ger, or oppress him. For you are strangers in the land of Egypt. Alright? Now the question over there is, why does the Torah say that we shouldn't afflict the ger because we were strangers? What does the fact that we were strangers have to do with it? That's not the reason why now it's afflict the ger. The laws of the Torah are objective. This is objective truth. Objectively speaking, it's wrong to afflict the ger. You're saying because we should relate with more. But no, that's not giving the reason. In other words, when you read it again superficially, it appears that that's the reason. That's how most people take it. Why aren't we permitted to mistreat the stranger? Because we were strangers. Implication being that had we not gone through the experience of being strangers, then it would be okay. Of course, that sounds ridiculous. Okay, so that's a good answer. You're saying that we have to be more sympathetic. Rashi had a strange reading. Rashi says that Moshe Bachar, if you put down the stranger, you know, you mentioned you call him a foreigner, a stranger, he'll turn it right back on you. And he'll say, well, you too are strangers in the land of Egypt. Mum Shevachah, your own blemish, don't place on somebody else. Ramban, look, the Ramban takes up the explanation of Rashi, takes up the explanation of the Eben Ezra. He's not satisfied with it. And he gives a fascinating idea. Let me quote you from Ramban. And this will give you a whole new insight into the nature of the faith of afflicting an almana. He says, what makes sense to me is that it says, you shall not afflict the ger, the stranger, or oppressor. And you think, because you think, the she'en lo makil miyotah, that he has no one who can save you from his hand. That's why, that's what you think. Because for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And I saw the affliction that the Egyptians were afflicting you with. And I took revenge against them. For I see the tears of the oppressed, who have no comforter, and who have no power to stand up against their oppressors. And he says, Adam, and I save every person from the hands of who is stronger than him. And so too, the Almana and the Yosef. Now you understand the category of the Almana and the Yosef. Lo ta'ano, you shouldn't afflict them, for I will hear their screams. For all of these people, einam bochem menachshem, they have no strength, they have no security in themselves, they have no confidence in their own strength, they're weak. The alai yiftichu, and they rely on me, they turn to me. The Lepasika Acha, he says in a different passage, God added an explanation, and says, v'yachem yedatem, that's the point he made, v'yachem yedatem es nefesh ager. You know the spirit, the soul of the ger. He can't leave somebody out to try him. But you were strangers in the land of Egypt. But he gives a different twist to it. He says, not just that psychologically, you know the feeling. More than that. Kaloma, the doctor, you know, ger you know that every ger, his spirit is very downtrodden. Mehunenach, and he groans. The Tzoeh, and he screams. The Ein of Tamidu Hashem. And his eyes are constantly focused on God. Be rachim alav, and God will have mercy on him. Kasharichem aleichem, as he has mercy on you. Kamoshe kasher, where did he say this? Where did he get this idea from? Where did he get this idea from? Exactly. The pasuk is part of pasuk kav gimel. Pasuk kav gimel. Day kav gimel, as he says right over there. It wasn't those days. By Yonchu Bnei Yisrael, when Avodah the Jews groaned from the work, by Yizakim when they screamed out, Vatao Shavasam El Elokim in Avodah. And their cries went up to God from the labor. Which means to say, it's aside from that idea that Malki mentioned before, it means to say that there's a completely separate idea over here. A totally separate idea. It's a universal idea. And that's the idea that the Brit Sufa, that God has a covenant with the downtrodden. What's he telling us? What is the psychology? What is the defect? What is the defect of the individual who oppresses the weak? To use that term to include the widow and the orphan. And why is it, as I said before, it's a separate category. It's not the same as oppressing a fellow Jew, but worse. It's a totally different category. Why? Exactly. Why is he attracted to the bully? Why is the bully attracted to the weak? Yes? In his mind, it's a denial of God. Because he's saying, this person, he wouldn't start up with a regular, he wouldn't start with somebody else, just because he has a father. If he, you know, he starts up with this person, he says he's going to tell his father, he's going to have to deal with his father. Starts up with a woman, well, you take a person will not maybe want to take advantage of a woman who's weaker, take advantage, but then he's held up. So go tell her husband. He's afraid. But then he finds this woman who's a widow who has no husband. Now he feels a certain boldness, a certain confidence. That's fear. That's the denial of God. And he's saying that there is no God in the world, and the only thing you have to be afraid of is you and Mike. That's why it's a completely different avera than oppressing the other person. Oppressing the other person is simply a defect. You have a defect, your selfish ego, that's one thing. This is more than that. This is an individual who is denying the existence of God. He's saying there's nothing but you and Mike. And if I can find someone who has no human protector, then I'm home free. That's very bad. Interestingly enough, that's what the halakha is. They're doing an Adonif and a Goslin. Right? It's really Adonif is a birdler who steals surreptitiously. And he has to say, not capable. If he's caught, he has to say capable, double the amount. But he stole. The Goslin is the murderer, the one who confronts you with force, with a gun. He has to pay back what he stole, but he doesn't have to pay. He doesn't have to pay the caper. So he still would think who's worse. He would often the murderer is worse, right? The burglar doesn't bother anybody. Now they'll say no, because the burglar is afraid of man. He sneaks in, he's afraid of being found out. I mean, he's not afraid of God. In the dark, when there's nobody around, he'll steal. The gosmer, at least, is not afraid of man. He's not thrilled, he's not afraid of man, he's closer. He doesn't have... What?
The Ganav is
different. In other words, he has denied God, but he does recognize human. He does recognize man. All right. The point that I looked at before here. All right. That explains, that's a very fascinating idea. Now we just have to try that. You see, by the way, that's really why throughout history all the bullies of the world, all the bullies are always the kind of Jew. The Jew is always the target, because the Jew appears to have no protection. Nobody likes them. These are always separate. They have no protectors. And that's why they're always picked on. I mean, aside from the other reason, anti-Semitism, but the bully always feels secure. Because he's going to fight to protect the Jew. It's a denial of God. So why is it that it says that they cry out to me? What's it got? You see, even without that, yeah? The last few words in the Ramban. He says, when he said, you know the soul of the ger, you were strangers, you know that the ger has no one to look to except to God, and God will have mercy on them, just like he had mercy on you. As he says, the children of Israel groaned from the work, and they cried, was not in their merit that they were redeemed. But rather that he had mercy on them in Avoda, from the Avoda. God had Rachmanis on them. Which means to say, I believe like this, that the person who picks upon the weak, who's attracted to oppressing the downtrodden and the weak, it's a denial of God. He's saying there's nothing in this world except human life. Now, that counts for God. If that person who's oppressed then places all of his faith in God, he's turning to God, because he has nobody else to turn to. And he cries out to God, but then God cannot allow this person to suffer. Because that would be a chilatam. That would be a situation chilatam. God's name is the best person in the world. People would say, they said, Ayei Elokeim, where is their God? That's why the question of the Jews and anti-Semitism always involves, always entails a chilatam. The fact is, because people do associate the Jewish people with God, and the fact is, after we see that this is the people of God, this can happen. And you see, in the case, that's why it has to be that they cry out. Because if they don't turn to me, so I'm not involved in the situation. I mean, as you're saying they don't deserve to be redeemed. Ramban doesn't seem to indicate that it's because they don't deserve it. Because he says it's not the truth. You didn't have it. The fact that you're being oppressed doesn't mean you have merit, and the fact that you turn to me to redeem you doesn't mean you have merit either. You're turning to God for help. Love the truth. You might have truth, you might not have truth. If a person is a target, their merits to be saved, so be saved. And the person who's not a tzaddik and doesn't marry to Yiddish Yehid, but the fact they call it the guard doesn't necessarily create the marriage. That's what you mean to say. They doesn't necessarily create the marriage. Not everybody cries out to God. Because if the fact that a person is being oppressed, look at this, the fact that a person is being oppressed and then calls out to God to be saved, if that creates the marriage, to be saved, then it's not just a downside to me. Anybody? That's what I'm trying to say. Allah yiftachu. Because once they turn to me, then God wants to do it. That's the point. No. Listen carefully. I don't hear you. But that's the case. But we just said that. What about the person who's committing the act is still a sinner Then I would say you're right. If a person oppresses the almana, and he does so because of this reason, because he wouldn't touch anybody else, but he feels this person has no protector, for this person to be punished. He'll say, but just the other one doesn't cry out to God, this one's going to get away with it. I would say no. Then, this person is committing a sin, it's a defect, and it goes on his record, so to speak, and God will deal with him as he would have dealt with, like any other sin. He'll be treated like any other sin. But this particular confidence that God will enact revenge against this person will not come into effect unless the person cries out to God. See, in other words, insofar as the person himself, so the person did a serious sin, and the person has to do tshuva. If they do tshuva, it'll be counted against them. But this special covenant that God will enact terrible punishments against them, that's only if the person is called out to Hashem. For example, meaning to say, like the Jews in Mitzrayim. You have to realize, if the Jews in Mitzrayim, there are more factors. The redemption was broken, there are other factors involved. But the prophet over here, according to Ramban, is telling you about another factor. And that is the factor that we've mentioned. Let's assume there was no other factor. And they oppressed the Jews because the Jews were weak and they denied God. Then the Jews had not turned to God. So this covenant, then the Egyptians would be dealt with, God would deal with them, in accordance with their sin. But it doesn't mean that God would have brought upon them all the afflictions that happened. You understand? The person who sins this way, the sinner will be punished. The person who sins this way will be punished. Now what that punishment will be, I don't know. But this particular punishment, of this particular covenant, that comes into effect, it could be that the person will not be punished in this world. It could be that the person will be punished in different ways. We don't know. Of course it's sinning. But his sin will be treated by God in a different way. It'll be treated purely from one perspective, how God relates to him as a sinner. However, when the person cries out to God, then a new situation emerges. Then, because of the Chol Hashem, then it becomes Chol Hashem. You see? And once it becomes Chol Hashem, it has to be treated differently. It has to be treated differently. Because God cannot tolerate the situation of Chol Hashem. And God has to write. That's what I'm saying. That's a lie. That's when they turn to me and they put all their hope in me, so God has to act and bring them to effect. That's what it seems to be. Right? So I think this is the beginning. This is about Talasav Vasav and Elohim. This is what it means that their prayer went up to God. It means it's telling us about this concept that God has a special covenant. That God has established a covenant with the umlolim, with the downtrodden, that whenever they pray to him, which means to say that they are in a situation where they remove all hope from anyone in this world to protect them, and they put all their faith in God, so then God will respond to prayer. That's the concept of the teaching over here. So that the geula of the Jews from the Mitzrayim had another determinant as well. Of course, because there was the basic determinant was the fact that they were designated by God to receive the Torah. But it's telling us a whole new concept over here about prayer and about how God relates to the oppressed. What's very interesting is, I'll come back to my mind later. The other question, to go a little bit further, now take a look at God is telling it to Moshe. When God tells Moshe, Rover, he says, on the Yom Yeshev Mitzrayim. The Yeshakos of Shemati, they know so. Yadat Yesh Machova. That's talking about one type of screaming. That's not the scream of prayer. That's the scream of pain from the work, which means to say that I have seen, in terms of the purpose of the enslavement and the suffering and the oppression, it's reached this point where it's fulfilled its objective. It shouldn't go on. It should not go on any longer. I've heard their screams, referring to the fact of the, which shows the desperate situation that they're in. It has nothing to do with prayer. Then it says in Pasuk Tesh, Ba'atah, Teenage Sakas Meso Boy Life, Vagami. Now it says, I heard the Sakas, I mean the prayer, well, it has come to me. That's supposed to be Tila. And I've also seen the affliction that the Egyptians are afflicting them. That's talking about the special covenant. There's another element over here. That we've created a whole new situation over here, a situation in which I must intervene, because not to intervene would be a triumph for those who deny the existence of God, because here you have a situation of a nation which is totally devoid of any help, and this nation is calling out to me and is putting its faith in me. I have to respond, because we're Bruce, he goes to the special capital. That's a good question on mine. Now, as I was doing this, I'm leaving this question to you. I'm leaving this question to you that the words of the Ramban, Dan, maybe you want to look into this. Take a look at further stuff. Look it up and see if anybody speaks about this. I know you do a lot of research. I meant that in a nice way. Parish of Days, 22, Parish itself. He says, Vani Matil Kol Adam Yad Chalzimah. This is a very important idea. Ramban says that God will save any person from the one who is stronger, which means whenever you have a situation where people are being afflicted by the mighty against the weak, and for no justified reason, obviously, for no justified reason, but only because they're asserting their strength. It's about one people capturing other people who are weak, and you make slaves out of them and oppresses them just for their own personal gain. And they're denying God. They're not afraid of anybody. No one should protect them. If this people were to turn to God and cry out to God, he says, call other men. He doesn't say Jews. He doesn't limit it to Jews. Now, when he says call other, does he mean only Jews, or does he mean call other many people? Now, the only question is, though, when you'll find many, every people, when they're down, will turn out and cry out to God. But are they crying out to God or to their own God? In other words, if they're idolaters, if they're unforgivable, then it's a dying. If they cry out to Jesus, then this is absurd, of course. This wouldn't work. Because the way we're learning it, it means it's a chilul Hashem, it's a desecration of God's name, that's the wicked triumph. That's the greatest desecration of God's name. That's just, by the way, we did that to Yadav Keshka. That's the whole purpose of the war against Amalek, because Amalek is a nation which is cursed. That there is no God. That's why they want to destroy the Jews, because the Jews represent God. It says that the throne of God will not be complete until Amalek is destroyed. But if just the opposite, if the nation, if people believe in Jesus as God, and they call out to him, good vision. That's precisely the point. No, it's a demonstration that it's false. It's totally false. So, however, if you have these people in the world who truly believe in God, and which would mean, I suppose, a righteous Gentile, Noah Chai, let's say, to believe in God, and he's being oppressed, and he calls out to God, but Ramban is saying that God will save them, that rift will come into effect. Unless, as I said, I mean, unless the Ramban system means it only applies to a Jew, which he doesn't say, just Kolobam. So I really can't answer that. I'm saying, you know, I have no problem with the idea of blind training, you know, in the universal sense. Now, can anybody answer the question, what's the concept over here that Moshe, God told Moshe to inform Paro? We had that where? There was Dollar, I believe. Does this shed any light on that? And you shall take the power of Bini Bechor Yisrael, my son, my firstborn of Israel. And I say unto you, send forth my son, that he may worship me. And if you refuse, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. Your firstborn son will be killed. He says, Isaiah says, that the Makas Bechoros, the killing of the firstborn, was different than the other Makas. The purpose, he says, in truth, the Makas Bechoros, Levada, Parishel Lemishpat, Onesh Leparo. The Makas Bechoros alone was for the sake of a judgment, of a punishment for Paro. But the other Makos were for signs. They were a sign and a wonder in order to get them to return. That was their purpose, was to get them to return, because God doesn't want to destroy them, but to give them a chance to do tshuva. He says, but Makas, I'm just skipping a few lines, but Makas Bechoros, and he includes the drowning of Paro and the armies in the Yamsuf, was judgment in order to fulfill Midah k'neged Midah. That was measure for measure. That was measure for measure. In other words, there's a significance in Makas Bechoros. See, there was a significance in Makas Bechoros because the activity of Paro was not just cruelty, and lack of concern for other people, and egotism, and selfishness. It was all that, but it was a denial of God, and a denial of God's relationship to the world, primarily to the Jewish people. That's the Nei Bechor Yisrael. When Moshe went away, he said, Nei Hashem, Asher Eshna Bekolo, who is God? Who is God, right, Susan? But God has to destroy all of ourselves. Two things. Who is God, and who is Israel? There's no God, and there's no Israel. It wasn't just Badamish Israel or God, I won't send them out. There's no such thing as Israel. This whole idea of the Jewish people is complete nonsense. It's a figment of your imagination. There isn't. Moshe was telling him more. Moshe was telling him that there's a God in the world, and that there's an entity of the Jewish people. You've got to recognize the Jewish people. It's on, it's the arm, it's an arm, it's a nation, it's a nation of God. There's a reality over here. And that was the whole point. That's why God intervened. And that's exactly why he warned them at the beginning. It's at the very beginning, he warned them. And when he warned them, he explained to him the framework, the whole concept of how God would relate to him. Neither connected neither. That God would relate to him because his actions were not just. The acts of fire were not just oppressive and harmful. It was the denial of God and the denial of God's Mashiach, God's anointed one, which is the Jewish people. So that's the idea of Makas Bechoros. Makas Bechoros is Midah k'neged Midah. That he acted to deny the existence of the God of the Jewish people, and that punishment would demonstrate that there is a Jewish people. The idea of Bechoros. Well, that's what I'm saying. That's all relates to. And that God relates to the universe. God relates, exactly. That God relates. That God relates. So that's a very important concept. And I said it's a new idea in terms of understanding what Makas Bechoros is all about, why that's particular. And this whole idea in this whole mitzvah that we've learned about, not to afflict, I think it takes on a whole new significance. Not to afflict the widow and the orphan, and the idea of this kusha, and as the Ramban explained it, he universalized it. That God has a covenant with mankind, that any time that there will be a oppressor who will turn his sight to someone because of their complete physical weakness, he's declaring that there's no God. There's no God. If that person would turn to God and set up God as their only source of help, then God has to return him.